I'm delighted to be talking to Michael Portillo, known to many as a hugely successful journalist and broadcaster, particularly for his travel documentaries such as Great British Railway Journeys and Great Continental Railway Journeys. Formerly a Conservative Party politician, he was Member of Parliament for Enfield Southgate from 1984 to 1997 and Kensington and Chelsea from 1999 to 2005. He's also served as a junior minister under both Margaret Thatcher and John Major before entering the cabinet as Chief Secretary to the Treasury, then Secretary of State for Employment and Secretary of State for Defence. He retired from the House of Commons and from active politics at the 2005 general election. Michael Portillo, welcome and thank you very much for finding the time to talk to us today. How are you doing?
Lynn, very well. It's lovely to talk to you and I'm looking forward to my visit to your part of the world very shortly.
Yes, we're looking forward to seeing you. So lots to talk about today. Should we start with politics?
Yes.
Okay. First question, why on earth did you decide to become a politician? It seems to me such a hard and unforgiving job and really insecure also. So why were you so interested? Why did you decide to do it?
You mentioned insecurity, and I'm surely the man who's given my name to political insecurity. The Portillo moment when I lost my seat in 1997. Yes, it's certainly insecure, and I certainly knew that when I first went into it. It's funny, when I was a boy, I had two ambitions. One was to be in television, and the other one was to be in politics. And so over the course of my career, as one door has closed, the other one has opened. I was born into a very political family. My father was a refugee from the Spanish Civil War. My mother was also very political on the left, both of them. The fact that I've turned out to be on the right is in a way kind of neither here nor there because I had the political bug from them. Very interested in politics as a youngster. I think I knew the names of all the ministers when I was young in a way that I simply do not do today. But actually, I kind of tumbled into it. I was bored in the first jobs that I took after university. I got a position at the Conservative Research Department. Really, one thing led to another. I became a Conservative candidate, I think because, you know, I had the knowledge of the inside. I was on the inside track. And then, you know, I did all right. My political career took off fast. It came to an end very early. I was still in my 40s when it all came to an end. But look, I've had a second career, which I've enjoyed just as much.
Absolutely. So during that time, what was would you say would be your proudest achievement?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed being a minister, which I was for 11 years. And I think I wasn't too bad at that. I mean, I think it's not difficult. It's basically you have to take decisions. You have to take decisions in a timely way. You have to be disciplined. The whole government machine requires you to take decisions. So people who avoid making decisions or who keep changing their mind throw the system into chaos. So I'm pleased with the way I performed as a minister, and in particular, I was very happy with my period as Secretary of State for Defence. It was a relatively straightforward period compared to what's come since. I was dealing with the breakdown of Yugoslavia and the horrific wars there and ethnic cleansing. And I think, you know, the West did a really good job. Maybe life was simpler in those days. A simpler achievement, perhaps, is that I was the Minister of Transport some years before that, and it fell to me to stop British Railways from closing the Settle to Carlisle Railway. And this was a more sort of single-handed thing because the responsibility for this decision was mine. And I was hugely helped by an organisation called the Friends of the Settle to Carlisle Railway, who rallied support for the railway. So we had this problem. The railway was losing money and the viaduct at Ribblehead was going to cost a lot of money to repair. Well, luckily, because the Friends rallied people, we had hundreds of thousands of people travelling on the railway on what might have been its last summer. And that helped to reduce the economic case for closing it. And then I found an engineer who could repair the viaduct for a third of what I'd been told. So we saved it. So that's a proud achievement.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. My husband would be very happy about that. Because we met on a train, my husband and I. And he lived in Carlisle at the time. So it's close to our hearts. I'm a northerner, as you can tell. So yes, well done on that one.
And yours has not been a brief encounter.
No, it hasn't. No, in fact, married 40 years this year.
Very good.
Wonderful. So you referred to it earlier about the insecurity of the job. And of course, you did unexpectedly lose your Enfield and Southgate seat. That was it 1997 during the general election there? And how did that feel for you?
Oh, well, it felt humiliating at the time. But look, we all knew in 1997 that the Conservatives were going to lose. And I must say, the thing that most motivated me was being a minister. That's what I loved doing. And in a way, losing my seat was just a sort of extra nail in the political coffin. And there was some relief. I mean, there was immediate relief because the Conservatives then were reduced to a rump of, I think, just 165 seats. And had I survived in my seat, I would have been expected to contest the Conservative leadership. And it would have been no fun trying to lead the Conservatives as a rump party. And indeed, the person who got the job, William Hague, had a pretty miserable time of it.
So you returned to the Commons. You weren't put off. You returned to the Commons in 1999. There was a by-election at Kensington and Chelsea, and you rejoined the front bench as Shadow Chancellor at the Exchequer. You stood for the leadership of the party indeed in 2001, and you came third behind Ian Duncan Smith and Kenneth Clarke. Now, would you say that was probably one of those crossroads, sliding doors moments in your life? What would have happened if you had become leader and eventually, indeed, prime minister? I wonder how the UK would have looked today.
Well,
I guess we'd have had a better rail system.
If I'd become leader of the Conservatives, I would not have become prime minister, because this was all the way back in 2001. And the Conservatives were clearly going to be out of office for a long period. And the person who got the job that time, Ian Duncan Smith, only survived 2 years. And I think that would have been my fate. It was a very divided party. The person who won and the two who lost each got about a third of the votes. So there was absolutely no consensus amongst Conservative members of Parliament as to who they wanted. And whoever got the job was going to have a lousy time. So again, a sense of relief. But at least this time, I made a decision that that was it as far as politics and I were concerned. And then I began to apply myself a bit to my media career.
Which probably worked out for the best, I would say. You seem to have a happy time in your profession. You always have a big smile on your face. And I have to say, you are a delight to watch. I enjoy watching you on TV because you are so interested and you do seem to enjoy what you're doing, which I'm sure at times in politics was not always the case.
It's obvious, isn't it, what a lucky person I am, because the job I have is absolutely marvellous. It is so enjoyable. So I skip around Britain and the continent, and in fact, the continents of the world. We've now filmed on five continents over 15 years. We've done many, many series of railway journeys. And as you say, it's a voyage, a journey of discovery. We meet marvellous people. I get to do lovely things. I get to do some silly things because I'm not very physically apt. So I'm always being made to do sports that I cannot do and to dance, which is something I hate to do.
So you're not going to see him on Strictly then?
You won't see him on Strictly.
No.
The programme is a kind of strange sandwich. Sometimes we're dealing with quite harrowing subjects. And then suddenly the next scene, I'll be making a fool of myself dancing. And I suppose in a way, this is what sustains the program.
Yes, and it is. You get that feeling from watching it. It doesn't look set up. It looks like it's spontaneous. And if it isn't, then that's a great achievement. Before we talk about the programs, I just want to finish off a little bit about the politics, if I may. So what do you think about the current state of our politicians and politics in general? I mean, I personally I'm disheartened and disappointed by it all. It seems we are always looking at some sleaze allegation on all sides, politicians generally. We vote for a prime minister and the party decides they don't want him. And so he's pushed out and we get someone nobody voted for a couple of times. We just seem to switch and we're all over the place. Do you understand why voters seem disinterested and disillusioned by it all? And does that disappoint you?
Of course I understand, because I am simply a voter myself these days. I'm nothing else. I don't have any other position. I don't have a position in public life. But look, I think the House of Commons probably represents the people of this country, which is the way it should be, which is to say that there's about 10% saints, about 10% villains, and about 80% who are in the middle, and, you know, are a sort of muddled middle, you know, with some good qualities and some less good ones. As far as I can see, the people coming into politics today are as good as ever in terms of intelligence. I mean, you see people coming in who are very, very bright. What is completely lacking, as far as I can see, is leadership, is people willing to say what they think, people wanting to have an argument, as Margaret Thatcher always used to want to have. She wanted to go on television. She wanted to be challenged. People now hide away so that they cannot be challenged. And I think we have very fundamental problems in this country. To me, you know, almost nothing works. The railways certainly don't, but more importantly, the National Health Service doesn't. We have huge problems with prisons, with immigration, with our police services. And nobody is talking about fundamental reform. Nobody's saying we can't just muddle on, we can't just give it another billion. We've got to do things differently. We've got to look abroad, for example, and see how people are more successful than we are in other countries. And we have to be humble enough to copy them. None of them is saying that today. And so I'm about to say none of them is of any interest to me at the moment.
Okay, so let's leave the political things aside now. Let's get back onto your broadcast and journalist career. The first time I saw you probably was on the This Week programme. That was a regular satirical political programme. I never watch political programmes. I avoid them like the plague. But I did watch that because there was a light-hearted element to it. It was generally intelligent conversation with a little bit of humour thrown in. So it was a really great programme. You were a co-commentator with Diane Abbott, which seemed a very, you know, it was going to be between the two of you. Your nicknames on the programme was Itchy and Scratchy. Was that how you were off camera?
Yeah, on camera, we got on very well. You see, the BBC had brought us together arbitrarily, but hadn't spotted that we had been at school together and knew each other at school. I was producing supposedly a film version of Macbeth, and I had cast Diane Abbott as Lady Macduff. Unfortunately, the film was never completed, so we'd been robbed of Diane's.
That would have been brilliant.
Performance, yes, it would have been brilliant. But anyway, so we, you know, we had this background, and we got on well, and it was the middle of the night, which, you know, we began at about 11:30, which, funnily enough, made a difference. You have more license as to what you can say in the middle of the night. So we used to say some pretty outrageous things and didn't often get caught up with it. But we certainly spoke our minds. I mean, Diane, you know, was generally against the establishment of her own party. And I was by then, you know, out of the Conservative Party, so we could speak our own mind. And she could be very clever because she knew that people would read transcripts. So when she wanted to say that, you know, she supported Gordon Brown to the hilt, she would say in a very silly way, "I think Gordon Brown is the greatest prime minister that the country has ever had." And we all knew that she meant the opposite, but she couldn't be caught out on the transcript. So we used to have a lot of fun like that.
You were also a co-commentator with Alan Johnson. Now, he always came across as a really genuine man, and he seemed quite a level-headed sort of chap. Was that how you found him?
Absolutely. Alan was a great person to be in the studio with, because again, he spoke his mind. He was a bit like me in a way. I think he was nervous of acquiring the highest offices in the land. He was at one time Home Secretary, but he got very spooked when he was Shadow Chancellor, because I think he thought, well, I don't know much about economics. Why is he such a level-headed man? Well, he was once a postman. For a long time, he was a postman. Came up through the post office union. And since he's left politics, has written, I think, six terrific books, four of which are autobiographical and two of which are thrillers. And I recommend them to you.
Oh, OK, I'll give them a go. So the programme sadly ended in 2019, I think. Yet it was popular. It was a really popular programme at the time. Do you know why it ended?
I don't think it ended for any good reason. Within the politics of the BBC, this was a programme on BBC One, which is meant to be a sort of, you know, popular channel. And I don't think we were ever very welcome on BBC One because we were not, you know, a massive audience programme. So I don't think we had much tender, loving care in BBC One, and the programme was allowed to die off. But I'm very glad that you're saying that the programme is missed, because I think something like it ought to be recreated. I mean, I'm now probably too old to fill the position, But I do think the BBC should think about finding a new programme that fills that void.
Okay, so your nickname on that programme was, apart from being itchy or scratchy, Michael Choo Choo Portillo and Sad Man on a Train. So let's talk about your love of trains, shall we? When did that start?
Well, my love of trains may be a briefer conversation than you think, because I'm not really all that crazy about trains.
Oh, this, no!
I know, and this gets people very, very disappointed. My love is history, and the train has been a fantastic vehicle to history all over the world. So I'm always slightly worried when people, you know, when people greet me in the street and start talking to me about trains. The program is mainly about history and about peoples, about different peoples who live in different parts of the world and how they've got to be who they are and where they are. So really, it is the history which is my passion and my driver.
So it's train travel rather than trains themselves as a method of getting you from A to B, which brings me on to HS2.
Yes.
So what do you think about that and the situation we're now in?
Well, firstly, I've no doubt at all that Britain, in common with every other developed country, needs high-speed rail. It's impossible to survive on an infrastructure that was built nearly 200 years ago. And no other developed country is trying to survive on an infrastructure built two centuries ago. So one day, Britain will have to have high-speed rail. Now, it's dreadful that we are incapable of building it at anything under, I don't know, 5 to 10 times the cost that other countries are paying for it. You know, my other country, as it were, is Spain, and Spain is now covered with thousands of miles of high-speed rail, which is entirely reliable and, you know, a proper infrastructure for the 21st century. So one day it's going to have to happen, and it's just so disappointing. You know, before too long, we're going to be 50, and then after that, we'll be 100 years behind some of our, you know, rivals and competitors.
It's quite depressing, isn't it?
And in this, as with so many things, it seems to be that no one is accountable, no one is responsible. In the whole HS2 debacle, I've never heard who was the person in charge. No one seemed to be in charge. Absolutely extraordinary. Tens of billions of pounds and nobody's in charge.
Oh, it's too depressing. Okay, let's talk about the travel documentaries. We've got Great British Railway Journeys, the Great Continental Railway Journeys. It's hugely successful. It's been running for quite a long time now, hasn't it?
15 years. We just finished our 15th year of filming. You don't mind putting in a plug for something, because outside railways, I make other documentaries as well. And I've got a documentary series which is going to start on November the 7th on Channel 5. And it's about southern Spain, about Andalusia. Now, Andalusia, you know, I'm half Spanish, but Andalusia is kind of the bit of Spain that I've adopted because we have a second home there. And it's a really passionate explanation of why I love Andalusia in 6 parts, beginning on Channel 5 on November the 7th. So that is imminent.
That would be really interesting. So would you say, are you moving away from the railway journeys now and looking at other projects?
No. It's just that it's sensible to have eggs in more than one basket because you never know, you know, how long the BBC will keep running on the railways. But no, I'm committed to the railways. We'll be filming a 16th year of railways next year, that's for sure.
Wow. So, yeah, you visited, how many, do you know how far you've travelled and how many countries you visited?
We've completely lost track of it all, except that it's been 15 years and 5 continents and obviously hundreds of hours of television.
So where is there left? What is there to see that you haven't visited? Is there a place where you wanted to go and it wasn't possible? Or are there places that you still want to see that you haven't been to?
The places we'd like to go and which are more or less impossible are, sadly, there is a list. I mean, places like Egypt, because it's probably too dangerous, although the railways are marvellous. South America, because so many of the railways have been grubbed up, taken away. Difficult to film in China now because of the political situation. Difficult to film in Japan, oddly enough, because it's so expensive. However, we're never discouraged because it doesn't really matter if we go to the same place as long as we are telling a new story. I mean, I don't know how many times we have filmed in London or Tunbridge Wells, you know, time and again. But each time we go there, we have...
Dangerous place.
We have a new story.
Brilliant. Well, we're looking forward to the next series, and that would be great. Is it a big team that travels with you? What are the logistics behind the program?
If I said half a dozen, that would be more or less right. So the person who films it is also the director. Then we have a sound engineer. We have a very important person called a producer, who tends to be a woman between about 23 and 30, university educated, bright as anything, masses of energy, who has brought all the ideas of the program together and is in touch with all the people that we're going to be interviewing, and keeps us on schedule. And then a couple of people who, you know, drive a van. Ah, yes, there is a van, and carry the equipment and so on, and who are probably, as it were, the trainees for those high-ranking jobs of the future.
Sounds fun, and you're full of energy, and you're looking great on it. So obviously, it's doing you good. So you're coming to Tunbridge Wells. Let's talk about your show when you come to Tunbridge Wells.
Yes.
You're coming to the Assembly Hall. That's Monday, the 6th of November. You mentioned coming to Tunbridge Wells. Have you been to Tunbridge Wells often? Do you know us very well at all?
Between, you know, political visits in the old days and filming in the new days, and indeed going to the theatre, yes, I've been to Tunbridge Wells quite a few times. And there may well be people, you know, coming to the show who have seen my show before. But, you know, basically speaking, it's a 50-minute presentation of a few jokes and a few anecdotes and quite a bit of reminiscence and a bit of, a bit of humour and a bit of poignancy as well, followed by 30 or 40 minutes of questions. Notice I don't say questions and answers, because I used to be a politician, but questions at least.
You're a brave man.
I enjoy it very much, actually. I enjoy that.
I'm sure you do. We're looking forward to seeing you. Sadly, we're almost out of time, but before we say goodbye, I do have to ask you about your clothes. My husband has made you his style icon. He's, for a man that used to wear blues and browns and greys, he's like a peacock now. He's desperate for a pair of red trousers like yours. He'd be very embarrassed that I'm saying this. Where did that love of vibrant colours come from? Or is that just part of the show? And why didn't we see you when you were in Parliament? You really should have worn them then.
Well, when I was Secretary of State for Defence, I got into great trouble with my Minister of State, who's Nicholas Soames, and he's a grandson of Winston Churchill, because they used to wear flowery ties. And he said, how can the Defence Secretary wear a flowery tie? And I do see his point. But, I mean, clearly there was this sort of thing inside me. There was this urge that was bursting out, that there was this flower trapped inside the dark blue suit. And it has erupted pretty virulently since. But it may help you to know that I'm colorblind and that I get dressed in the dark.
No.
No.
I don't believe it. Well, we look forward to welcoming you in Tunbridge Wells in the brightest outfits possible, please, or I'll be terribly disappointed.
Thank you so much.
Michael Portello, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, and thank you for joining us. We look forward to welcoming you to the Assembly Hall, Tunbridge Wells, on the 6th of November. But for now, thank you, Michael Portello, for joining us. It's brilliant chatting to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.